it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Room and Board, handcrafted furniture for your home at roomandboard.com. Well, today it's what happened when two actors, Michael Tucker and Jill Eikenberry, took a leap into the unknown in Italy. It all started with the food. Michael tells the story. His book is Living in a Foreign Language, a memoir of food, wine, and love in Italy. Well, slick cook Sally Schneider tells us all about one of her survival recipes, roast a pear her way with all of her improvs, and you've got a season's worth of dinners sewn up. The go-to man for New York City is Mike Colomeco, and he's got the go-to tapas bars in town. Then it's new and economical ways of reworking that old kitchen. Architect Sarah Susenka has the brief. And then Seattle chef and empire builder Tom Douglas has bought the farm, literally. And as always in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine.
So last week, Michael and I returned to one of our favorite places in Vermont, the P&H truck stop, and it was as perfect as it always was, except for the fact that they used to have wallpaper that showed semi-trucks on it and probably was purchased in the 1950s, and the owner of the P&H said they can't get the wallpaper anymore, so they re-wallpapered with non-truck wallpaper, but it was still perfect.
Now, is this the typical truck stop? I mean, you know, on the main highway, that kind of thing?
It's not the typical truck stop in the sense that the food here is really good. You know, most truck stops have pretty bad food, despite that old saw that truckers know all the good places to eat.
Yeah,
the P&H, you walk it, I mean, outside it looks just like a regular kind of independent truck stop, not one of the chains. And outside, sure enough, it smells like diesel fumes and the trucks are idling. But the minute you walk in, you smell fresh baked bread.
Oh.
So you know you're in a special place.
Do you know who we heard about this from? Years and years ago, Judith and Evan Jones.
Yeah, the famous book editor and her
they
husband.
They had a house in Vermont, and it was right near the P&H. And one day Judith said, you know, Stearns, we have such a place for you, and we've been going back there every year since, and it's just terrific.
So with this homemade bread, what do they do?
Traditional truck stop food. I mean, one of the great things to get there is an open-faced hot turkey sandwich because they cut thick slabs of this really good homemade white bread, put on turkey, dressings on the side, and you got the gravy. The one problem, however, is the mashed potatoes are not so great. Curiously enough, the mashed potatoes are listed on the menu as puree de pommes de terre. Because that's one of the really interesting things about this restaurant is that the menu is bilingual. So many truckers from Quebec go through here that the menu lists sirop d'érable pur for maple syrup, for example. I think the hamburger, they have a funny name for the hamburger. It's like hamburger bourgeoisie or something.
Do they do their French fries with the gravy on it the way they do in Montreal?
Of course.
Oh, this is great.
And you can make a perfect all carbohydrate and sugar meal there without any protein, because if you just order a basket of their homemade bread and then one of their fabulous, huge homemade pies for dessert, you have a perfect Stern-style meal.
With my French fries and gravy just
surrounded
out. Yeah.
Well, they have a maple cream pie.
Yeah, that's the thing to get.
That is like toffee. I mean, it's just absolutely wonderful, topped with fresh whipped cream and nuts. And the crust is a little heavy duty for my taste, but the filling is just delicious, and the slices are trucker huge.
And one of the things that's so interesting about this place is that even though the funky old trucker wallpaper is gone, what they did to replace it was to have some local artist paint murals of life in Vermont on the walls. And it's really this curious kind of wonderful folk art, you know, which is so odd to find in a real down-home truck stop.
I think it's almost like a diorama of the natural history of Vermont.
So you get educated, you get maple cream pie, and I'm imagining maybe cassoulet during the holidays, a little French
toast. I doubt it. No, it's strictly a trucker menu.
How do you say pot roast in French?
I have to think about that, and I'll call you.
Okay, because that's one of their specialties. And I know it's not called cassoulet, but I'm sure there's a wonderful Frenchy.
No, it's a translation of Yankee pot roast. And I remember there was a curious translation of Yankee, even that, like au façon américain or something. I don't know.
Hey, guys, thank you.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Au revoir.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving in the car. It makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Gina Michael Stern are authors of Road Food Sandwiches. The Sterns check in with us every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. You know, go to the website, splendidtable.org. Authority Sally Schneider has this ease with cooking. She streamlines basic recipes, and then she does all these intriguing takeoffs. She gives us permission to use our imaginations. Well, appropriately, Sally's latest book is The Improvisational Cook. Sally, it's good to have you back.
Great to be here, Lynn.
So what have you been working with?
Well, I'm working with something that doesn't sound like much, but is one of my favorite recipes and with which I survive all year long, really. I rely on them as a base recipe. These are simply roasted pears. Now, before you fall asleep, let me tell you that the other night I made some. They were in the kitchen. I made a double batch, and my friend's husband ate almost all of them when we weren't looking. So these are really something. They're simply pears that are halved. You can peel them or not, and we'll get to that. Then they're roasted with a little bit of sugar, lemon juice, a little bit of butter, and I like to throw in a split vanilla bean. You roast them at about 400 until they are meltingly tender and caramelized. They will have an incredibly intense, concentrated pear flavor.
Right there, I'm sold. Okay.
So you got it.
I got it.
That's
okay.
The gist. Now, from there, you can embellish them any way you want in the cooking. I like them as is, but you can add cracked coriander and cumin, maybe with a little lemon zest for a kind of Moroccanish feel.
Uh-huh.
I'm thinking pink peppercorns might be nice, or a dusting of ancho chili, thyme sprigs. You get the idea.
So you can take them savory as well as toward the dessert end.
Exactly. And you can serve them savory or sweet. For example, I love seckle pears, which are in season in the fall. These are very small pears with a kind of ruddy exterior.
Mm-hmm.
I don't peel them. I cut them in half. I don't core them because leaving the stem and the core looks very charming on the small pears. I toss them with the sugar, butter, lemon juice, throw them in the oven. Pay no attention for about a half an hour, and you end up with this gorgeous kind of tumble of pears, which are perfect in lieu of cranberry sauce or as that kind of sweet sauce we like with pork and chicken and game birds and things like that.
I'm hearing Thanksgiving.
Yeah, exactly. It lets you off the hook with the cranberry sauce and does something really beautiful, or you can have both. They're terrific alongside sliced prosciutto di Parma or Serrano ham or even a slice of pâté as a first course. With a salad, there's nothing like pears and watercress, and roasted pears are even better. And then as a cheese course, think Roquefort with walnuts or an aged goat cheese or something like that. So And that's just with Seckel pears. Now, you can do this with any pear you want. Take a larger pear like Comus or Bartlett. I peel them. I cut out the core but leave the stem, roast them exactly the same way, and they really love to be dessert. Think putting them in a shallow soup bowl with just a dollop of whipped creme fraiche or some ice cream or maybe a custard sauce that you've put a few threads of saffron in or a blackberry puree. They're great to fill a pre-baked pie shell or phyllo shell.
You know what I'm thinking, too? Once you've got all that caramelization and all those good flavorings, I mean, you can use anything on it, right? You could puree them and you could freeze them and make like a sorbet.
Exactly. Exactly. Beautiful.
I'm sold. This is good. All right.
All right.
So we're talking about, let's just review it. We take the pear, we cut it in half. If it's, you can core it if you want to.
You can core it if you want to. You can peel it if you want to.
And then it is sugar, butter, lemon juice, 400 degrees, and get it caramelized. Do you have it lying on its side? Is it standing
good
up?
Good question. Good question. I usually start it core side up, and then halfway through I turn it core side down so the smooth, I mean the round side gets nice and, and sort of glisteny and golden. And when I serve them, you can serve them either way. They're really charming. There's something about seeing that stem and the real shape of the pear because they're only cut in half that's really beautiful.
That sounds great. I'm thinking of roasting them with sprigs of rosemary.
Beautiful. And you know what else? You can chop them up or mash them coarsely for a play on applesauce. You'd have a roasted pear sauce, which would be really something.
Oh, and that'd be so much more delicious with all of those flavors. Oh, I love
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
Hey, Sally, thank you.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Sally Schneider's latest book is The Improvisational Cook. Now, you can get Sally's recipe for roasted pears on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, sign up for our e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. This is our weekly attempt to make your midweek kitchen life a little simpler. You get a new recipe each week, along with shopping and technique tips and whatever seems to be pertinent at the moment. And best of all, Weeknight Kitchen's free. So sign up at splendidtable.org. Coming up, Michael Tucker on living in a foreign language and hot tapas in New York City. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is supported by Room & Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed for a lifetime. You can find handcrafted American-made furniture and accessories for every room in your home at roomandboard.com. Now, this is not a new story, but it is living a dream that a lot of us have. A couple goes to Italy, they fall in love first with the food, then with a little cottage on a hillside in the middle of nowhere. On impulse, they buy the place. And then it's, how do you live a life there? Well, the couple is actors Michael Tucker and Jill Eikenberry of TV's L.A. Law fame. And it seems this impulse to move was at least partially to support a cooking habit. Michael tells their story in his book, Living in a Foreign Language, a Memoir of Food, Wine, and Love in Italy. Michael, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You know, Michael, I look at the book and I think that the subtitle should read, We'll Move for Food.
that would work. I've moved all over the world for food.
I mean,
but it's gotten me to some pretty nice places.
Well, it sounds like it. But how did you come to find this house?
Well, it was a total mistake. I had been trying to talk Jill into buying a house in Europe for years, and she never got it. You know, we were living in California then, and it would mean, she said, well, why do we want a weekend house 6,000 miles away? And I said, no, there's something about living there. We have to live there. It's not visit. And this was kind of an ongoing argument.
Right.
And we were on our way to a birthday party of a friend of ours, and she was having her birthday in Puglia, you know, at the bottom of the heel of the boot of Italy. And on our way down, We were taking a trip that the sole purpose of which was to have at least one great meal a day. We saw no churches, no art museums. It was all great meals. And we sort of stumbled on this house. We ran into a woman. She had been an ex-William Morris agent, and she was now living over there, and she was selling a little real estate. And we saw this house. And we said, we'll be there 5 minutes. And 4 hours later, we were still sitting under the pergola with these fantastic people that were selling the house who had become great friends of ours. And I looked across the table, and Jill looked at me, and she nodded. And that was it. The earth moved. And I asked her later, I said, why now? What's the difference? And she said, because it's home. And it really is.
Huh. Why don't you describe the house for everyone? Explain where it is and what it's like.
Okay. We're in the middle of Umbria, which is in the middle of Italy. They call it the green heart of Italy. It's also some of the greatest food in Italy. We're in the middle of serious olive oil country and serious black truffle country.
Mm-hmm.
The house is a rustico, which is like a farm worker's cottage. It's about between 350 and 400 years old, and it's tiny, made of stone, and as I say, sitting in the middle of all these olive trees.
And it's on a mountainside, right?
Yeah. There's a mountain. We're about halfway up the mountain,
uh-huh.
And then we look out onto the Spoleto Valley, which is a beautiful agricultural valley.
I love the way you described it. You didn't start by saying it's in Umbria, and you didn't start by describing the house. You started by saying it's in, there's olive trees and there's black truffles. So you bought a house.
That's the way my mind works.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So what, you've always cooked. What happened to your cooking living there?
This was interesting to me. My cooking, there's kind of a bell curve. I started out very simple when I was a kid.
Uh-huh.
And the more I learned about it, and the more I love cookbooks. And it got complicated. I took Chinese cooking lessons for a time and did a lot of Chinese stuff. And French cooking was really big for me. And the more kind of complex the recipe, the better for me. But not now. Italy has simplified me. Now I know it's all ingredients,
mm-hmm.
cooked perfectly. You know, one taste with another taste, and that's the best eating.
Yeah. You know, there's one piece about moving abroad. People, have this romantic idea, I'm going to buy a house and I'm going to become part of Italian life. And then they realize that all those people in that charming village are not waiting at the entrance of the village when they drive in to embrace them.
No.
How did you deal with the language, with the culture? Because suddenly you stop being a tourist.
Yeah, we're still dealing with it. You know, it's sort of a long, slow growth process, but it happens to be a very enjoyable process because the people are generous. And they know we're making an attempt. We spoke a little Italian. Then we took an intensive in Rome, and that really kicked up our Italian. But that was a very interesting time. An intensive in Italy means the class goes from 9 in the morning until noon, and that's it. You know, the rest of the day is yours. They don't like to get too intense over there.
Did the food help? Because you had to deal with food.
Of course. You know, the first thing I do when I move into a place is start inviting people to dinner. We started having parties. And there's an expat community, so there's some English-speaking people. But primarily, it's Italians. And it's hard to cook for Italians because they have very strict rules about things. And so I was breaking them all because I didn't know the rules. And I cooked a carbonara for a guy who's become a very close friend of mine. But he's a Roman, born and bred in Rome. And carbonara is the most Roman of dishes. And I substituted Parmigiano for pecorino, which is a sin. I mean, an absolute sin. And a couple of other things. And he called his mother in the middle of the meal. He picked up the phone and called his mother. He said, "Ma, you won't believe what this guy did." But he had a second helping, so it worked out okay.
And now he's making it that way, and all of Rome is talking about it.
Yeah, right. And he's taking full credit for it because he's a Roman.
You talk in the book about something that you call jumping off the edge, and it's about your marriage. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I think a major theme of the book is if you have a relationship that you know you're going all the way with, you can do anything. You can fail together. You can succeed together. You can go sideways together. It doesn't matter. You can have fun in any direction. And there's a sort of a bliss involved in that. I feel like I'm a very lucky person.
And so was buying this house jumping off the edge?
Oh, definitely. It was definitely jumping off the edge. We knew if we did it, it was going to completely change our lives. And it did. We ended up, everything has changed. We were living in California. We're back to New York, which is very important to us.
Mm-hmm.
It's changed my family. Suddenly my family, which is my daughter was in L.A., my son was here, my mother-in-law was here, and we were all over the place. Suddenly everybody's living within two blocks of each other.
And you think the house did that?
It just happened. I think Italy did it. Italy, there's, you know, every place we go is a family place. We go to this wonderful restaurant, trattoria, in our neighborhood. It's really, it's like a truck stop. And it's called the Palazzaccio.
This is in Italy, you're saying?
In Italy, yeah. The falling down palace. And it's run by a family. This guy was a truck driver. His wife cooked for his friends, and eventually they made it a restaurant. And now his three daughters run it, and Mama's still in the kitchen. He's gone. And their daughters are now working the kitchen, and the babies. They're carrying the babies around, and the little cats are crawling up the thing, and the one kid's over there doing his homework, and the other one's waiting on the tables. Mm-hmm. And it's a wonderful place. We go there two, three nights a week, and we've become very close friends with the family. But it changed the way we think about family in a very good way.
Mm. Michael, thank you.
Great time, Lynn. Thanks.
Michael Tucker is author of Living in a Foreign Language, a memoir of food, wine, and love in Italy. Now, for an autumn dish from Italy, check out Emilia-Romagna braised pork ribs. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, if you want to know about eating in New York City, the one person to go to is Mike Colomeco. Now, his daily radio show, Food Talk, is heard across the city. He covers the city's food scene from eating on the cheap in Hell's Kitchen to going behind the kitchen doors of great restaurants. And Mike spent a lot of time in those kitchens as a chef. Mike, it's good to have you back.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Mike, I see tapas being hot. I mean, it's still going on all over the country. But is it kind of over in New York City?
Oh, I don't think so. I don't think so. In fact, I think we were probably late to the game.
Really?
You know, Spanish food is so good. All of us that have been fortunate enough to have traveled. But, you know, New Yorkers kind of came to it slowly. There was a place called Solera years back that I loved that never made it. I think the advent of Ferran Andrea, who's just maybe the hottest chef on the planet today, I think he's kind of brought the spotlight onto the cuisine. And now there's really good tapas to be had in a good half a dozen to a dozen places around town that's authentic, that's well-prepared, that's passionate. And it's a great way to eat because, you know, by definition, it's just lots and lots of small plates.
So where would you have us go?
Couple of places come to mind. One of my favorites is Teopol. It's this little restaurant. I guess it's kind of far west Chelsea, a little north of the meatpacking district.
So you're talking the 20s, right?
Yeah, we're talking. Let me give you the address here. I sound like an idiot, but I'll dig it up here. 10th Avenue, just south of 23rd Street.
Okay.
It's funny because this is the area where you have places like Morimoto and Del Posto and Budokan. You know, these 10,000 square foot, these restaurants that look like Yankee Stadium that cost millions of dollars, and sort of stuck right in the midst of that is this little place. I don't think it's 600 square feet. You walk in, there's a little bar to your left, maybe six or seven tables, a kitchen with one of those little swinging kind of bar doors.
Right.
And inside are a husband and wife, Eder and Alex. He's Spanish, she's American. Met years ago cooking in New York City and just really wanted to do great kind of Basque-style tapas. And it's great. You know, you go in, sit at the bar if you're by yourself or with friends and there's no table. Wonderful wine list, lots of rosés, lots of wines for single, you know, $6, $7, $8 a glass. And just really great tapas food. Plates of olives, little, you know, the little fried compositions, great salads, great tortas, just really simple food. And the two of them are in there every day doing this.
This sounds dynamite.
Another one is a funny one that comes to mind. Seamus Mullen, not the kind of name you'd expect to
associate. Seamus Mullen doing tapas.
Seamus Mullen, who's an American boy from New Hampshire, I believe, is the story. I've met him. He's a great guy. He worked in Spain for years, speaks perfect Spanish, and was tapped a while ago to open up a restaurant called Boqueria, which is just off of Union Square Park in that neighborhood. You know, midtown, kind of Chelsea in the middle of Manhattan.
Yeah.
Wonderful restaurant, real busy, great bar to eat at. And the tables are kind of high, that's Spanish style, so that even if you're tall, you sit at these chairs and your feet kind of dangling. You feel like you're sitting on a phone book or something. Again, wonderful food, probably the best paella in the city. Lots of small plates. He and his business partner, Jan de Roquefort, opened up another restaurant that's a little more upscale called Suba, S-U-B-A, which is on the Lower East Side, that's just maybe some of the best Spanish food in New York City. Not exactly tapas, but really, you know, they sort of turned everything up a notch. My favorite, and this is a hole in the wall, and I probably shouldn't give it out because it'll never be the same. It's called Nacional, 14th Street, between 7th and 8th, North Side.
Now, that's an old neighborhood of Hispanic population, the Hispanic community.
Exactly right. And the building that it's in is like one of these, I think the Spanish government owns it because there's a Spanish flag outside, and the place is, nobody knows about it. You walk in, it's literally a few steps down from the sidewalk.
Yeah.
The walls are painted as sort of like ugly, I don't even know what the word is, you know, magenta. As you walk in, there's a TV set, and God forbid there's soccer on, you'll never get a table. And in it are a whole bunch of Spanish expats of various ages, little dining room, wonderful chef, and, you know, I don't even get the menu. I just tell the chef, hey, I'm going to have six or seven plates, send out whatever you want. Again, this is a place that even New Yorkers don't seem to know much about.
Well, we won't tell anybody, I promise.
Yeah.
This sounds so great. I'm just so surprised New York's just discovered this.
New York was funny to come to this so late. Don't have an explanation. The good news is it's here, and it's a great way to eat because, you know, you can have, if you come with a group of three or four people, you can have 20, 25 little plates, pass them around, pair wines with it. It's really casual, really fun, and the price points are really, really moderate.
You always make me hungry. Hey, Mike, thank you.
Thank you, guys. Always a pleasure, Lynn. Be well.
You too. Mike Colomeco hosts New York City's daily food talk show on WOR Radio. Now, you can get Mike's tapas finds on the website, splendidtable.org. With housing sales dropping and all the mortgage troubles, me thinks that the McMansion with the big designer kitchen is a pass for the moment. We have to make do with what we've got. Well, enter a maverick architect. Sarah Susanka believes big is not better. She's author of the Not So Big House series of books, and she rethinks space better than anybody I know. Sarah, it's good to have you back.
Oh, it's great to be here, Lynn. Thank you so much.
So, I'd like to talk about the not-so-big kitchen and the dining room or dining area.
Right.
How do you think out what you've already got to get maximum pleasure and maximum function out of it?
Well, this is a great question, and it's something that people often jump over thinking they've got to add on to make their kitchen
and
their dining area work.
Or change the cabinets
right.
or
and there's
whatever.
So many things you can do first. So what I encourage people to do before they begin any kind of other planning is take a look at just the footprint, the shape of your kitchen and your dining area. And without moving the what we normally call the utilities, the sink, the cooktop, the ovens, etc., is there a way to make better use of that space?
Right.
When most houses were built, say pre-1970s, the kitchen was this isolated room. And so the very first thing you need to look at is how do I open up the view between the existing kitchen and the dining room or the rest of the house. Right, so that you get some visual connection. So the first thing is try to get the kitchen to link to other spaces. And you can do that just with openings like interior windows or I call them connecting views.
Right, right.
Obviously, you need a builder or a structural engineer or an architect or an interior designer to help you know what you can and can't do. Mm-hmm. But most people see a wall and just assume that it's a big, big project to move it. It isn't always. And then in terms of what you've got in your existing kitchen, oftentimes it's very poorly laid out. So you end up with doors that make it like a hallway, you know, where you're walking from one corner of the kitchen to the other to get through to the next room.
Mm-hmm.
And so it bisects the room. It ends up being very difficult to work in that room because you've got people coming and going all the time. So if you can move a doorway so that you end up with a U shape or something that then just gets all the countertop contiguous so that it continues around, makes an enormous difference to the kitchen's utility.
What about the opposite now. I'm thinking of the open floor plan, which may be even, it may be your studio apartment.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have the problem of you kind of want to be able to do something when the kitchen is a mess.
Well, there's a couple of different things. And let's take the apartment dweller for a second. One of my favorite solutions is to take a blind, like a Venetian blind, hang it on the ceiling, and then you can just lower it when you don't want to see the kitchen. And then there are other things, if you've got a little bit more money to spend. One is a raised countertop that when you're sitting at the dining room table or the informal eating area, you can't see into the kitchen, and so blissfully it all goes away.
That'll block all that mess.
It blocks the view. Now, there's something that about human nature that I want to point out, and I learned this by just working with a lot of clients who spend lots of money creating sliding partitions, etc., to hide the kitchen. The reality is that when you've got guests sitting at the table, it feels really weird to suddenly slide them closed so they don't use them. They look like a great idea, but the reality is that the people we have over are Joe and Kathy from next door and not the King and Queen of England. And so, you know, what we end up doing, we're much more comfortable with the informality when it comes right down to it, for most people.
We had a discussion a while ago, and you talked about lighting.
Yes, hugely important.
You could just have the kitchen lighting on a different switch that you can just bring it down on a dimmer so it's dark.
Not completely dark, because that then looks like, you know, no man's land. It's sort of like the basement. So what I usually do is leave maybe the under cabinet lighting on. So it gives a nice wash to the kitchen, but very low level.
Okay. Center island. How do you keep that center island from being
the repository of everything
you
that ever comes
into the
house?
Your keys go there. The mail goes there. The books go there. Right. What do you do for that?
Well, the key is that when you look at how you come into the house, you need a place that's before you get to the island, but still close to Grand Central Station, where you can put that stuff down. If that does not exist, the island will be the solution. So you've got to make either, I call it a mail sorting place, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, right.
But it's got to be big enough to be able to put that stuff down, but before you get to the island. And then quick solution related to the island, and that is make a lowered section of the island where that can be the junk collector, and then the upper part becomes still kitchen.
Sarah, thank you so much.
Absolutely, Lynn. Great to see you again.
Good to see you. Sarah Susanka is an architect and author of The Not-So-Big Life, Making Room for What Really Matters. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what is probably over your dining table that should protect your secrets? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is supported by Room & Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed for a lifetime. You can find handcrafted American-made furniture and accessories for every room in your home at roomandboard.com. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what is most likely over your dining table that should protect your secrets? It's the medallion or rosette on the ceiling. Now, stretching the point, it could even be the plaque where an overhead light is mounted to the ceiling. This is the origin of the term sub rosa, meaning private and secret. Now, sub rosa literally translates as under the rose, and it started in ancient Rome with a misunderstanding. The Romans thought the Egyptian god Horus was the god of secrecy. Now, he wasn't, but he was portrayed with his fingers in his mouth. Then word got out that Cupid gave Horus a rose for keeping his mouth shut about Cupid's mom. Well, now that was Venus, and she had a habit of having rather public tete-a-tetes. So the rose became the symbol of secrecy in Rome. Rose-like decorations were common over dining areas. When a meeting was clandestine, a rose was hung on the wall. Now, this went on for centuries. You still see rosettes, for example, in confessionals in Catholic churches. But most often, they're the decoration in dining rooms. Eventually, chandeliers were hung from them. But always that decoration means anything that happens under it is private. And I think that's a reassuring thought when that third bottle of wine is opened.
Hello? Hey, what's going on? How come I never see you around no more? Where you been? Yeah, well, you should call me.
Okay, let's open up the lines to the phones, brought to you this week by Palm Wonderful. 100% authentic pomegranate juice at palmwonderful.com. The number is 800-537-5252. Let's see who has been waiting patiently. We have got Daniel calling from Portland on the line. Hey, Daniel, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I'd like to talk about clams.
Oh, great.
Several weeks ago, I went clam digging with my family in Puget Sound, and we wound up digging up a bunch of fairly large butter clams, which were too large to just steam and eat. And so after trying some experiments with about half of them, we didn't know what to do with the rest. And to make a long story short, we did steam them. I liberated the meat from the shells and put it on ice, and I brought it home. And I was thinking to do, I mean, the obvious thing would be, I guess, some sort of clam chowder, but
right.
I was wondering if you knew something maybe a little bit different, kind of a hearty clam stew or something else I could do there.
Yeah, because what I'm thinking is if you look at clams, because butter clams are usually a little on the chewy side unless they're really small, right?
Yeah, it's just like eating an octopus, yeah. Definitely.
Yeah, yeah, you need to do something to it first. If you look at clams as being a meat, right? Why
yeah.
not do them as a ragu? I mean, why not do them? Just a thought. All right, how about this?
Okay.
Let's pretend that they're a piece of tender pork. Take a little olive oil and garlic or maybe onion. Quickly brown. They're cooked, right? You've already steamed them.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and you want to tenderize them some more.
Yeah.
Okay, why don't you give them a fast browning?
Okay.
In a little olive oil, take them out of the pan, throw in, you know, some onion, a little bit of garlic, cook that until it's nice and soft. And then how are the wild mushrooms? I mean, when I think of Portland, when I think of Oregon, you guys have wild mushrooms up the kazoo, right?
Oh, definitely.
Oh, why don't you cut up some wild mushrooms, brown them into that, maybe do something like a sherry reduction over that, you know, just pour it over and let it boil all completely away.
Okay.
And, you know, if you want to have some fresh herbs, you could have some fresh herbs. But the idea is a little sherry, do a reduction, add just the smallest amount of cream to that.
Okay.
All right. Throw the clams back in and just let it simmer gently until the clams are really tender and those mushrooms are now really, really tender. And you could have a wild mushroom sort of clam ragu.
That sounds fantastic.
And if you wanted to, I mean, I'd eat that straight, but the other thing you could do, imagine what that would be like over pasta. I think that could be wonderful.
That sounds great. Should I cut up the clams first before I brown them?
Yeah, I think I would. I would cut the clams down into bite-sized pieces, give them a quick, you know, sear, get them a little bit browned. You may even want to, you know, dip them in a teeny bit of flour and then give them a quick brown, get them out of the pan, then do that sauté, throw them back, and let everything cook until it's tender.
That sounds absolutely wonderful.
And if you wanted to add a very small amount of fresh tomato, like if you had, how many clams do you have at this point?
I'd say about a pound and a quarter of meat.
All right. So with a pound and a quarter of meat, you'd probably want to equal that in mushrooms. And mushrooms cook down a lot. I would use one sort of medium tomato that I would dice in.
Okay.
And let that cook with everything. It'll just give it a nice little lift. And the sherry would be wonderful. You could use white wine. But I'd love the idea of sherry in there. I just think sherry's a nice, you know, little, I know there's no word for that I can think of other than that sound.
I know just what you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, put that over pasta, put it over rice, or just eat it straight. It would be great.
Okay. Well, hey. Thank you, Lynn. You're wonderful.
Hey, my mouth is watering. I want to be in a place where I can go clamming. Oh, Daniel, thank you.
Take care.
You too. Bye. Call us, 800-537-5252. We have got Jeffrey calling from Seattle. Hey, Jeffrey, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. This is the guy with the cocktail parties in Seattle.
It's that Jeffrey from Seattle. How are you?
Oh, things are going fine for me. Thank you for asking.
Is it already time for another party?
Well, you know, I plan out a few weeks, but I'm going to be having it at the end of the month. So I already feel behind.
Let me explain to everybody. Jeffrey does these outrageous cocktail parties, totally themed parties. People come in costume. You redecorate your apartment. And he's always got these great ideas, and then he sends us pictures and the invitations, and they're the coolest thing. So what's the theme this year?
Well, we're getting in the way back machine. We're stepping out of the 50s and going back into 1920-something.
Okay.
So it's the, you know, the classic speakeasy theme.
Right, right.
And I'm trying to get inspired because the food of the 1920s is like, you know, breadcrumbs and meat byproducts. And
well,
I'd like
no
to have
way.
The traditional
now,
from
wait,
the 20s. But...
Wait a minute. I'm thinking of this was the era of Jell-O becoming a big deal and these really fancy little dancy salads like Waldorf salad.
I know.
Maybe this isn't what you want to serve.
No, that's good, actually.
Yeah, I mean, Waldorf salad can be really cool.
That would be great.
Yeah.
And so I'm up for those kinds of ideas. But I was inspired by at least one place in Chicago that was an Italian supper club. And I was thinking I would bring in some Italian flavor and do antipastas.
Oh, that's a great idea. But do them as they would have been then.
Well, sure, I'd love to. I barely know what antipastas are today. I'm Norwegian, you know. So I don't know what would be some of your favorite antipastas and how far can I stretch the definition because I don't just want to serve, you know, herbed olives and salami slices.
I have to tell you, that's very modern, what we would call hoo-ha Italian. You know, we've gotten very classy these days and quote-unquote authentic. But I think what you want to do is do the real Italian-American stuff.
Sure.
If you did eggplant Parmesan, and you know, eggplant Parmesan, if you bake it off and then hold it for a couple of days, you can cut it in small squares and put it on picks and you know, rewarm it, but you can serve that. You would have things like, well, those awful marinated artichokes. I think they're absolutely awful, but it's the kind of thing you would have. You would have salami, you would have olives, but old-time antipasti, you would have had small homemade meatballs and tomato sauce, but again, you would eat them with a pick.
Great. Perfect.
You would have something with beans, with oil and vinegar, little diced salami and onion and garlic. So you might take, for instance, canned chickpeas. You can use almost any canned bean. Rinse it, marinate it in oil and vinegar and garlic, and then do a little sliced red onion with it and little bits of salami. And That's hard to eat with your fingers. I mean, that would have to be something you have off of a small plate.
Well, there'll be plates and forks.
That's there will be. Okay, that's great. Pickled vegetables. Vegetables that have been pickled with green herbs, garlic, vinegar, and olive oil. Often they're called giardinata. And they're things like little bits of cauliflower and sweet peppers, and they would be little tiny onions. And that's a nice counterpoint to the richness of some of the other stuff.
Great.
So do you get the basic idea of what I'm talking about? And then,
cheeses?
Oh, the cheeses. Now, if you want to be old-time Italian 1920s.
Sure.
Provolone, sharp provolone, and you'd want it cut in cubes, and you eat it with your fingers, okay?
Okay.
And then roasted peppers, roasted yellow and red peppers.
Okay.
Cut them in small squares so people can just, you know, plop them. You'd have coarse bread. You know, you'd have a real rough grain bread that you'd have broken up into small chunks. And you know the other great thing you could do? Straight out of the 50s, the 40s, the 20s, the 30s.
Yeah.
Garlic bread. But you do garlic bread, you know, with a long loaf of a baguette, right?
Yes.
And what you do is you stew in olive oil a lot of garlic and a lot of green herbs like oregano and basil and marjoram, okay? In fact, if you really want to capture the taste of the era, Italian seasoning, the mix you find in the spice section of the supermarket.
That's what I cook with.
Okay. That's the old-time Italian flavor. You throw a bunch of that in there, and then what you do is you brush that onto the two sides of the bread, okay? You can throw cheese in there if you want to. You know, you
okay.
can throw mozzarella in there or whatever, and then you put the other piece of bread on it, wrap it in foil, heat it up, and then you can cut that into small pieces and people can just nibble on it. It's delicious. I mean, it's absolutely fabulous.
Wonderful.
So you've got all this kind of old-time stuff. I would do a tray of cold meats like copa, salami, prosciutto with fresh figs or fresh fruit of some kind, and roll them up so that you can just spear them and you pop them in your mouth.
That sounds terrific.
Okay, so that's the basic idea. And then you would have the olives, you know.
I better stock up on garlic.
Oh, you're going to need a lot of garlic.
Perfect.
They are going to love you.
We'll do the Charleston for you, Lynn.
I love it. I'm going to be thinking of those long pearls. I can't tell you.
Exactly.
Hey, Jeffrey, thank you.
Thank you.
Do your usual, send us all the good stuff, you know, and pictures of the party and the whole thing.
I sure will.
Okay. Have a great time. Take care, Jeffrey.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye. You can call us 800-537-5252. Chef Tom Douglas has his own kingdom in Seattle. I mean, restaurants like Etta's, outlets like Serious Pie, and a weekly radio show. My point is, this guy never stops moving. So I go to his newsletter, and it begins with, now I'm quoting here, "There comes a time in every man's life when you have to own a farm." Well, I've got Tom on the phone. Tom, welcome.
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
I'm good, but, you know, Tom, you've got eight food operations, and now you have purchased a farm. What in heaven's name were you thinking?
Yeah, my wife talked me into this, and every chef, I think, would make a good TV show. Every chef dreams about being on the farm and, you know, bringing things right from the ground all the way to the table. And,
right, right.
And, you know, you read about, here in Seattle, we have the Herb Farm, and they're just so precious, and they do their thing every night, you know, 40 people, and it's all the same food, and it's fabulous. And you read about little chefy types with farms around the country, and they go out and pick their pansies before they serve them for dinner. And so, you know, I thought, I'm not the typical chefy type, but I thought, what the heck? You know, I could butcher a cow or two or something like that. Well, it is the classic city boy meets farm life. I feel like Paris Hilton.
And now you've decided your hands were not meant to be in the earth, I gather.
Well, you know, I'm out there. It's, you know, this is, people forget that Seattle's the rainy part of Washington State, but just an hour and a half over the mountains, it is high desert. And so I don't mind the drive. It's a beautiful drive.
Right.
When you get there, though, you know, there's a pool, and you're supposed to sit out by the pool.
Right.
But my wife just is gonzo nutso and has irrigated an half acre to start with. And so, you know, she gives me those puppy dog eyes and says, "Could you help me pick some beans? You know, it's 100 degrees in the high desert with not a tree in sight, and I'm picking beans."
Are you going to supply the restaurant?
Well, we did this year with a few things, and there were some things that were on the property that we brought in, like apricots and cherries. Well, actually, the cherries never made it because the damn birds took them all. But I would just rescued some of our grapes from the starlings. They were swarming the grapes.
Right.
But, you know, the first crop that we planted back in May, you know, we came out the first day after everything had started popping up, and it was gone the next day. We were like, what's going on? And then we just saw this harem of rabbits that had eaten everything that had come out of the ground. And so I don't know. I'm ready to sell it and move on, but I don't think it's going to be a possibility. My in-laws have moved in, and it's going to be a family farm.
Tom, I'm picturing the best-fed wildlife in all of Washington State. I'm seeing these rabbits lying under trees, scratching their bellies, you know, picking their teeth with a piece of straw because they love the lettuce you planted.
I've had some of my first revenge. You know, the neighbor's got 25 goats, and he doesn't have water rights. You know, in the desert, everything's about water rights. So we watered right over the fence, right next to our fence line. So all the goats would come over to our fence line. And I have this plan that as they're there, I'm just going to slip them under the barbed wire fence and get them onto my rotisserie before the neighbor knows what happened.
You are evil, man.
Yes,
you are,
ma'am.
So evil.
It's the farmer's revenge.
You know, Tom, we'll check in with you as the year goes by just to see how this new life works out for you.
All right. I'll call you.
Tom, you take care.
Thank you, darling. See you later.
Okay, goodbye.
Bye.
Chef Tom Douglas has six restaurants and a bakery in Seattle, and he's author of Tom Douglas's Big Dinners. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number's 800-537-5252. Have a great week, and until next time, let me leave you with this thought on autumn from Albert Camus. He said, Autumn is a second spring when every leaf is a flower. The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported by Room & Board. Handcrafted furniture for your home at roomandboard.com. Information on everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. Not only will you find invaluable newsletters and podcasts, you'll also find information on our new book, How to Eat Supper, Recipes, Stories, and Opinions. It's a collection of some of our favorite no-fail recipes and ideas, as well as stories and advice from some of our favorite guests. Check it all out, you know where. Online, splendidtable.org. Our show is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% authentic pomegranate juice, backed by $25 million in medical research. You can learn more about the antioxidant superpower at palmwonderful.com. Palm Wonderful, trust in Palm. And by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about food, menus, and cooking at Gather.com. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Judy Boudreau and intern Andrew Schumacher. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. Have a great week. Please join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.